I'm Dr. Megan Corrado, and welcome to Real Stories, a podcast that features the narratives of trauma survivors, professionals, and community leaders. Real Stories provides a platform for guests with diverse life experiences to voice and honor their unique narratives. During today's episode, we will be speaking with Kenneth Johnson. Kenneth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So let's start off with, can you tell us a little bit about who you are?
Okay. So I think the best place to start is just professionally. I'm a social worker here in Philadelphia. I work for the city's Department of Human Services, specifically Juvenile Justice Services. And I also part-time work as an adjunct professor. I'm sorry, that's my computer making all the noises, people. I also work part-time as an adjunct professor at Westchester University. Mm-hmm. I've taught a variety of courses there. Currently, I'm teaching human rights as a perspective in Philadelphia. Mm. I'm born and raised in Philadelphia, so I'm strongly connected here. I think that's pretty good. I love mentoring young people. I'm also a founding member of the Boys Track Mentoring Program, which is run out of Philadelphia's Department of Human Services.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's a few things. I'm sure as we talk a little bit, I'll reveal a little bit more.
Okay. And then you already answered this, but is there anything else you want to add about what you do?
Professionally? No. Just for outside of professionally, just to relax, I like to jog. Go to the gym, and I am an avid consumer of anime.
Okay. That's good. That's good to know. So every individual, every community, every system has a story. And we know that every story includes both adversity and strength. Can you talk to us about some of the adversities that you faced? And these can be either professional or personal, whatever you feel comfortable sharing.
As you asked that question, I'm actually reflecting, and I think that when I think about adversity, I personalize it in that I think that the adversity that I faced was more or less self-imposed, for lack of a better word. Mm. Maybe just really not knowing how much of an impact I could have in the realm of social work and just social action. This is early on in my career. Just to be completely transparent, you sent the questions early and to prepare for them. And this one, I had to really think hard on. Because so frequently I thought of myself as just really attacking adversities.
Hmm.
And
you mean as far as your own adversities, you experience them, but you just like focused your energy into overcoming them?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, like things would come up, challenges would come up, and I just, you know, focused my energies, marshaled things that I had learned. Throughout the years and through my experiences and found ways to overcome them. So when thinking about adversity, professionally and personally, I think that the adversity was just, I guess in a way you could call it self-doubt, you know, and overcome, how to overcome that and mobilize those strengths within myself. If I had to give a story about that, I'm trying to think of one. There was an issue where they were looking to make some significant changes to a program that I was connected to.
Okay.
I had a lot to say about it in order to keep it as it was originally designed. And I'm being vague on purpose because I don't want to out the particular organizations.
No problem.
Involved. And in the beginning of the conversations about the changes and what they were doing, I remained silent. And I really had to think about why I did that. Why I didn't speak up. So the next time we had a meeting about that, I made sure that, you know, as difficult as it was, and in a way, I guess you could say scary as it was, is that I pushed myself to do that, to say, you know, to speak my piece and my truth about it anyway.
What do you think it was that like prevented you from openly expressing how you felt about it from the beginning?
I say often, when I'm teaching, one of the things that I say to students is that as social workers, we have to be careful not to become agents of social conformity. And I think what was happening is that, you know, I had conformed to the bureaucratic structure and the belief that, you know, those who were titled to hold particular positions had a particular insight or knowledge or expertise that I did not. And I needed to defer to that. And, you know,
instead of trusting your own expertise and your own judgment about the situation.
Right. Instead of trusting my own experiences and expertise from actually working with the populations and being out there, you know, I remained silent. I think of that as an adversity because, you know, it was a struggle for me to come to the understanding that I was actually the barrier standing in the way of myself fully embracing the career that I had chosen. So, yeah.
And looking back on that experience, have you found that that tends to be a pattern for you or something that started early on where you have kind of known where you stand on a situation, but then maybe experienced some self-doubt, or was that the first experience you had with that?
I would say that looking at that, that wasn't the first experience I had with that, but it was the last time I dealt with it in that manner.
Okay.
Meaning that, for lack of a better word, that became my aha moment. And that, you know, the stakes for the communities and for myself are too high to remain silent. And to remain, you know, and to believe that what I have to contribute is not valuable. Or diminishing its value. You know, I had a responsibility to the communities to speak up. For those that couldn't speak for themselves. And knowing that having that direct interaction with them, you know, I had heard, and it's amazing, I'd heard their stories. And I had a good idea of what they needed to have come in to their particular community, into their particular programming and setting that would work for them. That particular space. I would say that to a degree, I'd fed into that idea that those who were titled, and I'm using the word title, had that, going back to what I said before, they had some knowledge that I didn't have. And the more I sat through and listened to them and interacted with them, they're very knowledgeable, very, very smart people. But, you know, myself and anyone that comes into those particular organizations or those particular rooms with those people need to realize that they too are just as valued, just as smart, and have just as much insight as those with the title sitting at the table.
Right.
The one limitation is they may not have access to the research, but their ability to understand and contribute shouldn't be minimized. And I learned at that point not to minimize my own.
So I'm thinking about myself as you're speaking. I'm also thinking about listeners who experience this like self-doubt. It's like, you know certain things about your own experience and you've listened to and empathized with others' experiences, but somehow like this sense of self-doubt, I don't know. It interferes with our ability to advocate. And I really appreciate you highlighting that experience as an adversity. And also It also speaks to the fact that sometimes we're our own worst enemy. And sometimes the adversity that we impose on ourselves can be far more powerful. The self-talk, the messages that we're conveying to ourselves about how valuable or invaluable our voices are can be far more powerful than what anybody else can do or say to us.
Yeah, and I think that you're absolutely right that what I found to be valuable and which is very difficult for me to do is reflection. And, you know, in social work and in therapy, and I know you know this very well, much better than I do, reflection is very important. Mm-hmm. Your ability to reflect and really understand what was happening in that particular situation or that particular interaction. Mm-hmm. And what it meant to you. And as you asked me earlier, why did I react the way that I did? Mm-hmm. And honestly understand it so that I can make some corrective action for myself going on. And for me, that's so important when we work with, when I do my work mm-hmm. with communities and with young people, is trying to get them to teach them those skills, not even get them to teach them those skills to sit down and self-reflect on mm-hmm. interactions and what's happening and what it means to them and where they were emotionally in that particular place, in that particular space, mm-hmm. and how they can use that information to move themselves forward in a positive way and achieve or accomplish whatever they have set out for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard a lot of stories of adversity, but also a lot of stories of strength too, as you're supporting youth in identifying ways to, experience a sense of empowerment.
I have one story. I have a bunch of stories because I've been working with young people for a number of years, mentoring and life coaching.
How many years?
Oh, wow. It's at least 8 to 9 years now.
Okay.
Yeah, since we started our mentoring group. It wasn't just myself. It's a group of us that started it.
Okay.
But when I think of one story, and this is actually a very good story, because the young man and his mother had a very, very close relationship. And she brought him to our mentoring. She brought her son to our mentoring program because she realized he needed that exposure to adult African-American males. He needed mm-hmm. that to mm-hmm. grow. He was going into like seventh grade, I believe. And she realized that, you know, as a mother, you know, there were some aspects of manhood that she just could not impart on him. And she wanted that help. Mm-hmm. She would wait for him after every session we had. She would sit for the entire session outside of the room we held it in. She would mm-hmm. make sure he got there, wait for him to come out with all the boys, escort him home. Now, the funny part was she was the only mother there.
Okay.
Waiting for her son. So while the interaction was going on, I came out because there are several other mentors in there with the young men. I came out and I sat with mom and I asked her, I said, how long are you going to continue to sit outside the door and wait for him? Mm-hmm. And she looked at me, well, you know, he doesn't always come right home. Sometimes he's real flighty in the way that he thinks and moves and, you know, it's dangerous out there. Very valid concerns, mm-hmm. mother. And I had to have a conversation with her and was like, can you wait for him downstairs? My point was, she had to start letting go. Mm. As scared as she was for him, and as we all are for our young people out there, it's like, you know, it's going to come a point in his life when you, no matter what you do, you cannot be there. Mm. And you have to be very sure that the lessons you have taught him have prepared him to the best of his ability in those situations, navigate them correctly. Mm. He was very young at the time. So, you know, not to send mom into full on freak out. I was like, you know, let's, why don't you start by not waiting here by the door when he comes out with all the other young men?
Okay.
Give him, start giving him a little bit of space and trust that he can make it from this room to meeting you outside. And eventually we'll get to the point where he can make it from the meeting and all the way home on his own. And it was a very short period of time. And through us continuously having that conversation, myself and the mother, as he worked through the program and she made slight adjustments as he showed the ability to handle the responsibility, to where he did get to that point where he was able to come to the program and go home. It didn't take away her fear as a mother, but she was more confident that he was going to make the right decisions traveling from the program to home. And just to bring it full circle, he's graduated high school. He accomplished so many things while he was in high school. And he has gone on to make some very significant, I'm being very careful about what I said. I don't want to put somebody out there that haven't given me permission.
Right.
But we're very proud of him. He made some really, really important life decisions on his own in conversations with his mother. And she just really appreciated his growth, and that all of us as the men there had a hand in helping her to have him grow and become the young person that he was. And anytime I see a young person that posts something or texts me back, and they don't have, they're not always amazing stories, but they're usually just to say, I'm doing okay. Thank you. It's not until they became adults that they realized what we were trying to impart on them and the importance that it has on their life after they left high school and really became full adults. And that's just so rewarding.
So as you're speaking, I'm thinking about like the fear that that mom must have experienced, to the point where she was waiting outside, for her child after the mentoring, sessions. And I'm thinking also about like all the different traumas that she and her family may have faced, especially, as an African-American family, living in a large city. And I'm thinking about, you know, the trauma and the stress that might have motivated like her desire to say, I want to protect my child. I want to make sure my child is okay. And then I'm also thinking about, I really appreciate you sharing this story, especially because sometimes when we're working with people who have been through adversity or who need support, sometimes we think that there's going to be these like monumental, like life-changing aha moments that are really dramatic, like we envision fireworks and smoke and fog machines and all these other things. But a lot of times these transformative moments happen like when you have a conversation with a parent and it seems like a simple conversation. And then over time, that conversation builds into something else. And then over time, you can look back and say, oh, look at all this progress, even if it wasn't this monumental, explosive moment in that person's life, it's still extremely significant and powerful.
Yes, and that's exactly what I wanted to get across, is that it's not the big things always that we should be looking for. It's the little incremental changes. Another quick one, and this can be for any number of young people, male or female. I know that when we oftentimes when we're moving through the city, and I'm going to use males in particular, young men in particular, we'll see them and they can come across as very intimidating and scary in their presentation. And I've had many conversations with family members and friends because of the work I do with mentoring was like, what I challenge them to do when they can and they're in that situation with a young person is really talk to them and then stop talking and listen and really tune into what the young person is saying. And the amazing part for me, I'm going to speak for myself, is that the young person can be 6'3", 200 pounds, built like a linebacker. But when I look in his face and in his eyes as I'm listening to him and interacting with them, all that fear that I held, I'm going to use fear, or all that, you know, hesitation from interacting with him melts away. And I realize he's 15 or 16. He's still figuring it out. And you start to see, well, for me, I start to see even his features soften. And you start to see the 15, 16-year-old, not
the child
monster person.
Right.
You know, this is, I'm not going to be afraid of a 16-year-old young man who's still trying to figure it out. And in his own way, many of them are begging for us to give them some information and some direction.
And also to see them
as
they are, not as, so, you know, we know that, you know, sometimes people are defensive, especially if they've been through trauma. And it's a self-protective mechanism to say, like, I don't know how you're coming, but I need to make sure that I'm protected and I need to make sure you're safe. So I'm going to put this wall up until you prove to me that you're safe. But then, so seeing that part of them and accepting that part, but then also seeing like the child behind that is really important.
Yes. And as you said it, like taking when we can see beyond the trauma that they put up front, that's that wall that you speak of, and then see the young person that's still in need of understanding and direction, changes the whole way that you interact with this young person. And it changes the whole way that they receive you. You know, I can remember, she's now a grown woman. She's one of the first clients I ever had when I started doing social work. And I was doing as a case manager. She has to now be like 35 and she has her own children, but she and her family still call me to this day. And this is a funny story when you know you've had an impact on someone. And she has her own children and will call me for advice when they're, because they're all boys.
Okay.
She will call Mr. Johnson for advice. Like,
okay.
You know, like, listen, you know, you were always honest with me. When you said you were going to respond, you did. When you said that something was going to happen as a consequence of my actions, you did it with compassion and not anger. So the funny story is that she was on Facebook Live, is it? So she's on Facebook Live and I'm on Facebook. So I see her and of course I pull up the video like, hey, let me see what she's talking about. And she's talking nothing controversial as young people do. But then I came up to, I was like, is she driving? You know, so I type in a message like, I know you're not driving and videoing while you're driving. And she talks into the camera. All right, everyone, I have to say goodbye. Mr. Johnson just sent me a message. And Mr. Johnson, I'm turning off the camera right now. But and little actions let me know that I had an impact on her. And she knows
right.
as I come across that I'm have your best intentions at heart. I want the best for you. And right now, what you're doing is not very safe for you.
I'm also thinking about this idea of reparative experiences. So we know that trauma creates disconnection. It creates chaos. It creates, I don't know, broken relationships. And we know that actually building healthy relationships with other people can help to repair some of the negative impacts of trauma. And it sounds like the core of your work goes back to reparative experiences, helping people to feel a sense of safety and connection and respect and empathy and consistency. And I think it's important for everyone to know that all of those things can support trauma survivors in recovering and healing. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be that you're talking directly to people about the trauma that they're going through. You may, depending on your role with them, but just thinking about how over time you were able to build these experiences and relationships of repair that then led to trust, that then led to people realizing, you know what, everybody is not going to harm me, because, you know, in the back of my head, I know Mr. Johnson has my back. Like, I know that I can rely on him. I know that he is a safe person. And that's incredibly powerful.
Yeah. And outside of even just myself and the groups that we have for both the young men and the young women, and they're all inner city dealing with all these shootings and a lot of the violence that's going on. You know, a lot of them come from families that lack, whether it be money, food resources, clothing resources, housing resources. You know, all these different young people come into our program. And we want to create an atmosphere where they can come in and it's safe. And I'm going to use you can come to us and truly be 15, 16 years old. Mm. You don't have to carry the weight of the adult in the room here in this space. We're the adults here. And to our role in your life as it regards this program, we're carrying that weight. You just focus on all the things that need to be focused on for a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old.
That has to be a relief.
You're right.
Like I don't have to be so responsible. Like, I can be myself, and the adults around me are just going to take care of what needs to be addressed.
Exactly. We're going to take care of when it's time to leave. We're going to take time when it's time to eat. We're going to deal with the argument between these two people over here. There's no need for all 17 of you to come circle around them and spice it up. You know, we're going to take care of it. No one is going to be allowed to be hurt in here, because we're not going to stand back and let that happen, either physically or emotionally. And if we see it, we're going to address it. It's not ignored. From the person that is the person that is the target of what's happened, and the person that's doing the targeting, because they both need to be addressed.
And right,
as the adults in the room, once we get those two to understand the dynamic of what's happening between them, then we can bring them together. And as young men in our program, you guys can disagree and talk about anything. No one in this program is throwing any blows in the building or outside of the building to solve their differences. It's not going to happen. We're going to teach you a different way. You never have to agree with him in this moment for what's happening. But what we're not going to do is allow you to take this moment as the definition of who this person is. As a totality. It's not all that person is. It's a disagreement. That person within this context.
So you've already shared a few important positive moments or turning points in your story and your career. And I'm wondering if there's anything else that you want to add.
I would say one of the positive turning points career-wise was there was one of the gentlemen who restarted the mentoring program that I started with. He was actually very instrumental in me going back to graduate school.
Okay.
In that he had gone himself, and he had completed it, did amazingly well while he was in the program. And we're in one of the groups, and he said to me, while I was sitting up there, why haven't you gone? Like, you know, like, why haven't you done this? Like, you know,
so he called you out.
He called me completely to the carpet. And I appreciate him for that. He called me on the carpet, and I had a million excuses, and which is amazing. And I explained it. And I had a million excuses: time, money. I wasn't ready. You know, in the end, it kind of takes us back full circle to where I started this. And it was more self-doubt. So, like, the people who do this must be incredibly intelligent people to accomplish this graduate degree.
But you didn't consider yourself to be one of those incredibly intelligent people.
I was afraid, and I didn't see myself in that space. and fear. But I had been involved in the work with the young people for so long that I couldn't be a hypocrite. I had to face that. And I had to face that fear. And this other Black man, you know, pulled me on the carpet and was like, you know, do it. You know, you can do this. And lo and behold, I did it. And as you know, Megan, I was not only did I do it, I completed it. And almost immediately after I graduated, they pulled me into as an adjunct professor.
So not only did you do it, now you're teaching too.
Now I'm teaching. And I think this podcast that you're doing with stories is very transformative, I think. In a way, reflective for me. You've given me the opportunity to kind of reflect on many different aspects.
I'm glad
that are going on currently with myself and with the work that I'm doing.
Okay, so where do you see yourself in the future moving forward?
I see myself as a NASA astronaut, actually.
Really?
No.
I was gonna say, wow, that's a career change.
That's a complete 360. Where do I see myself in the future? I'm really not sure.
Okay.
Just to be completely honest, I know whatever I'm doing, I'm still going to be in this service helping profession.
Okay.
On some level, you know, I'm still going to be out there and having that direct involvement with the community and with the people. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm still going to be that guy. Eventually, I am going to retire at some point.
Okay.
Then I'm going to have to consider, you know, what does that look like?
Right. And then also, given that you've been involved in multiple things all at the same time, that's going to be a change for you too.
Yeah. Like, what do I do? What do people who don't have five different projects going on? What do they do?
I don't know. I do not know.
You know, like I know you don't. We've talked. So I know that you very much are involved and active in so many different things going on. That's a hard question for me to, I'm not going to say reflect. I'm going to say project forward on.
Okay. So, like, okay. We can hold space for, you know, the uncertainty. That's okay too.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, how do I project forward? And that could be a good, thank you. That could be a good workshop for the young people. Project forward.
Absolutely.
You know, I have to really think about how to structure that.
Right. And then sometimes we know like in the vicinity kind of what we want to do. And sometimes we have specific plans. And I think it's helpful for us to make space for both of those things. A specific detailed plan. And then also like, you know what? I'm not sure, but I kind of think it's going to be in the area of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. And I'm still using my word projecting for it. I'm still figuring it out. And you know, for this segment that I'm talking with you about here, for young people, that's a good message I can have for them, is that even as adults, we're still figuring it out.
Right.
We're still as anxious and afraid at times and unsure in a different way.
Right.
And they are, but those feelings are still there.
And normalizing that.
Right. That it's okay. You know, it's okay to be unsure. It's okay not to know. It's all right not to have the answer. But don't stop looking for the answer.
Right. Absolutely. So a couple last questions. Are there any life-changing or favorite resources that you want to share with listeners?
Life-changing resources. This is going to be funny, but anyone who needs to relax, I always throw my anime references in there. Get Hulu,
okay.
Get Hulu and start watching anime.
Okay.
it is, I find it very relaxing, and it covers so many genres.
Anything specific?
Anything specific?
Yeah, like any of your favorite anime.
If you're going to start, for me, at the beginning, everyone has to watch Akira.
Okay.
They have to watch Akira. They have to watch Sword. It's called Sword Art Online.
Okay.
You have to watch that. There are so many out there that I think that where they've done like an amazing job of making a social commentary. If you really take the time to look at what they're really trying to say to the community at large, you can get so much from. And that's any art form. I'm just using
anime
as one. Another resource, more along the lines of academically, is, and a friend turned me on to it, is called Teaching Hard History. I believe it's through the ACLU.
Okay.
Get the actual to you, Megan, so you can put it up.
That would be great. I'll include the link for people who are interested.
Yeah, Teaching Hard History. It was given to me by a very good friend of mine who's working on his doctorate right now. And I've been reading through it, and it goes through the different age ranges. That I think is an excellent resource. Anything else that I would really want to share?
I know there's so many like potential resources too.
Huh?
There's so many potential resources too.
Yeah. And it's amazing. Now you're sitting here I'm sitting here on the podcast and give it out, and I'm drawing a blank. And I think part of that is, as social workers, we're so reactive that we actually have the person come to us with an issue or a problem, and it kind of triggers us.
Right.
And it comes.
Then you remember the resources. You're like, oh, I have this for that particular issue.
And then when you put in a relaxed mode, what do you have? It's like, why am I trying to access that part of my brain? Like,
there's not a crisis.
Yeah. Like, I'm not in a crisis. Like, no one really, really needs this at this particular moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they do. I guess my last resource is just be good to yourselves. I find that relaxing activity that you can do that's just special to you. Whatever it is.
Anything else you want to share with our audience before we close?
I look forward to meeting everyone at some point. It's a lot of people in the world with a lot of stories.
There are.
And I want to hear a lot of them and give me the opportunity to learn from them. That would be my closing words. Oh, and to the best of your ability, everyone, you know, don't just criticize our young people. Really invest in trying your best to understand them.
Thank you for listening to Real Stories. The resources referenced by today's guest speaker will be included in the episode description. For more information about me, Dr. Megan Corrado, and my work with the Stories Trauma Narrative Intervention, please visit my website, www.storiesguide.com. Also, feel free to follow my story social media pages on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Remember that for every story of trauma and adversity, there is always a story of strength and resilience.